Welcome to this week's edition of the Baseball America College Podcast. I'm Teddy Cahill. Joining me, as always, is Joe Healy. And we are here to talk about recruiting class rankings. The final 2021 top 25 was released yesterday as we record this. It was released September 8th, so you can check it out in its full over at baseballamerica.com. And Joe and I are going to dive into those rankings and, you know, just kind of talk about some of these incoming classes here. So always an exciting time to be able to look at the newcomers that have made it to campus. And that is what we are going to do today on the Baseball America College Podcast, which is presented by Rapsodo. Rapsodo has become the industry standard in player performance data. Coaches use Rapsodo data as a measuring stick for player development and evaluation. The Rapsodo National Player Database is a free service that allows you to see how you stack up against your peers and provides a pathway to get discovered by scouts. You can check out the Rapsodo National Player Database at rapsodo.com/national database. All right, Joe, here we are. We're past Labor Day. Kids are on campus and in school. Players are on campus. Folks are starting fall practice and recruiting rankings have been released. It is that time of year, and I always get really excited about doing this. I guess that's a good thing since I am the one that spearheads this every year. But this is one of my more favorite projects to be able to dig into the newcomers and, you know, just really kind of start educating myself about what teams are going to look like. I mean, I start this process like a year in advance of signing day. And we take that's when we first start ranking the classes, and sometimes, you know, we get some midseason updates leading up to this final one, but those all include players that might get drafted. And, you know, we all know that that's a reality of college baseball. But now we get to just focus on the players who are in college and will make an impact on these programs for the next 1, 2, 3, maybe 4 years. And so it's very exciting to see all of that come together and then kind of get released out into the wild in the form of these recruiting class rankings.
You mentioned that, you know, it's one of your most favorite projects, and you said that's a good thing. And I agree. I feel like this would be a specific slog if you really did not enjoy this aspect of it, because every year when you put these out, and I don't just say this to blow smoke, I mean, I truly mean it when I say that, you know, I'm impressed just the level of depth you have to go to, because, okay, sure, maybe there's a class or two that really stand above the rest and like, okay, there's your one and your two, but then you still have to rank 23 more of them. And at some point, as you get further down, you know, you've got fewer and fewer BA 500 prospects. And so, you know, it just becomes a little bit more of a game of splitting hairs. And I think inherent in that is the fact that, you know, ultimately you're ranking a lot of unknowns. You know, we don't know what any of these kids are going to do. You know, the history is littered with, you know, BA 500 prospects that don't work out and relatively unheralded prospects who become all Americans. And so that's the beauty of it. But yeah, this is a, you know, seeing the back end of all this work that goes into it, like I come away impressed every year. And I think it's a great roadmap if you're a college baseball fan who's a little more casual. You know, obviously the hardcore college baseball fans, especially of the SEC programs, are well aware of these kids already and have been tracking them for years. But if you're more of a little bit of a casual observer, I think this is reading these recruiting rankings are a good entree into the next class of kids who are going to come in and try to have an impact right away. And so, you know, when you combine it with some of the other stuff we're going to be doing coming up in the next few weeks, as you mentioned, it fall coming up here and being upon us, you know, the combination of this, you know, an update we're going to do to our transfer rankings with our top 100 transfers who are coming in to college baseball in 2022 or changing places in college baseball in 2022. And some of the other little pieces we're going to have coming, previewing different individual teams for the fall. You know, what we're trying to do here with all this is create like a nice little sampling platter for you to start to prime the pump a little bit for ultimately the 2022 season.
Yeah. And you're talking about how, you know, if you're really into it, you've been tracking your team's recruiting class, and like that, it's probably true, but yeah, I bet you haven't been tracking your opponents. So, you know, if you are into that, or if you just want to know more generally about who the top freshmen are in college baseball, I guess this is kind of the place to go to for that. And if you really want to dig into it, you can. I mean, it's like 12,000 words, but it's there for you. So, you know, it'll take a little bit to read through, but hopefully, you know, we are able to cover it in somewhat of a comprehensive manner that I don't think you can find anywhere else that's like that. So yeah, that's my pitch for going over to baseballamerica.com and reading the top 25 after we break them down here. And since I guess Joe brought it up, let's just touch on a little bit of housekeeping before we dive into the top 25. Like he mentioned, the transfer rankings will be updated within the next little bit here, and those will be over there on the website. As well as last year, we debuted a series that we called Five Questions, and you know, we took each individual team five questions they were facing this fall and looking ahead to next season, and kind of tried to get into answering those and you know, how things might start shaping up for those teams. So we're going to run that back this year, and again, look for that probably starting in the back half of September. Got to let some of these teams get a little bit of fall going so that we might be able to suss out some of these answers. But before too long, we'll be able to get into that as well. And there will be more recruiting coverage content as I go conference by conference and team by team for, you know, the biggest conferences in college baseball. So all of that to come over at baseballamerica.com. An exciting time. Yes, it's the fall and not actually college baseball season, but it's still the season. You know, the season never really ends if you don't want it to. And here at baseballamerica.com, we don't want it to. So we've got plenty to come here, and it's a good time to subscribe if you're interested in any of that, or the pro side as we start end of season type of prospect coverage over the individual professional leagues and going team by team, of course, building towards the prospect handbook.
There's definitely something about you mentioned you know, this time of year and kind of all that comes with it. I don't know about you, but it starts, this is, well, obviously the season is probably my and yours favorite time of year, and actually having the start of the season and what have you, but this kind of is a close second for a lot of different reasons. And, you know, you start to get that chill in the air. I recently was on a trip. I went out to Colorado for a family thing, and there was a little chill in the air there, obviously up in the mountains. So it kind of got me ready for fall. And then of course I get slapped in the face by coming back here to North Carolina, and it's wet and warm and all that kind of stuff because fall is not yet here in North Carolina. So that was a little bit of a reality check, but I say all that to say, you know, there is something about this time of year. It starts to get a little bit cooler outside. Football is back, you know, college football for me in particular, is an exciting time for me. So that's back and going. So it does feel like, we're definitely going through a changing of a season here. And in many ways with the coverage we do this fall, you say that the season never truly ends. And I think that's more true now than it has ever been. With college baseball being as talented as it is now, the recruiting rankings take on even more importance. Transfers being so prominent in college baseball this year and probably moving forward means that's going to be another prominent piece. And so I think college baseball, while it doesn't have maybe the type of ecosystem around it that college football does in terms of year-round content, it too has grown in that same way. And I think it's only going to be more true as time goes on.
All right. So let's dive into this top 25, which is top by number one, UCLA. This is the first time we've been ranking recruiting classes at Baseball America for 22 years now. This is the first time UCLA has been number one, which on itself, like on its own, is a surprise. This is also the first time since 2010 that a school from the West Coast has had the number one recruiting class. The last one was Stanford in 2010. So it's been a while. Pretty much every recruiting class since that Stanford class that was the number one class in the country was in the SEC. They had a 9-year streak. Miami snapped that last year. And now UCLA is the first one to take it out of the Southeast entirely. So that is interesting. And then further, what's interesting is the actual way that this class came together. UCLA is they just recruit really well out there. John Savage recruits really well as a head coach. Bryant Ward, UCLA's recruiting coordinator, has done a really good job since he took over that job in Westwood. So that's all, you know, it's not abnormal that UCLA would have a really good recruiting class. But what's interesting about this class is that so many of these players at the top of the class said no to the draft. A couple of them pulled their names out of the draft formally, but before the event began, which, you know, it happens here and there, but to get two players from the same class to do it, going to the same school, that's very rare, no matter what part of the country we're talking about, especially so on the West Coast. And then you had a couple other players that after the first night of the draft, which this year was just 36 picks, said, "We're done. You didn't pick us. We're not going. And you see that happen now and again, but again, just so many players from this UCLA class made it clear that they weren't signable or that they completely removed themselves from the process, that UCLA wasn't necessarily sweating a ton going down to the signing deadline, just because so many of them had been removed from the process altogether. That obviously there's still some concern until the deadline does pass for any coaching staff. And UCLA did lose one commit in the draft, but they were able to hold this class together so well. It was the number three class after the signing period last fall. And, you know, it because they held together so well, they rise and here they are at number one.
The thing with UCLA that strikes me kind of from an outsider's view, because I'm not in these recruiting classes the way that you are, is that they just seem to do a really good job of getting their guys. And every coaching staff is going to say that, like, we just want our guys. But, you know, they have all different types of recruiting classes, like smaller recruiting classes and top heavy recruiting classes and recruiting classes that are more about depth and quality. But they're always highly ranked. And they're typically get the production they're looking for out of them. All you have to do is look at the recent track record for UCLA. And obviously there's a larger discussion about UCLA to be had that I'm sure we'll have as the season approaches, where, you know, this program that hadn't been to Omaha since 2013, and they've had opportunities to get back to that stage and have fallen short of it. So the program continues to kind of pace along at a steady clip here, and continues to be to show all of the signs of being a program that is one of the better ones in the sport right now. And it just doesn't necessarily have the results that you might think they would have based on that. And I'm sure that's a point of frustration inside those walls at UCLA, but a number one recruiting class, certainly not a bad thing to continue to build towards that. But it's, you know, it's, I don't think, you know, you mentioned John Savage being and this staff recruiting really well at UCLA, but I feel like maybe it's just because of the results, and this has not been a team that's been on the biggest stage in college baseball in a little while. Maybe that's the reason, but it does feel like this is a program that doesn't really get thought of in that same way as a recruiting juggernaut. I think people would, obviously Vanderbilt and then Florida, I think people would kind of associate with recruiting juggernauts. And even, you know, even a brand like Miami, the number one class from last year, I think people, because of that brand identity, might look at that way.
Yeah, I think it's a West Coast thing that they're just not being thought of that way.
Yeah, but to your point, I think they should be considered that way, because the proof is in the pudding there. And like I said, like, you know, this is a program that just every year they just kind of quietly get most of the best players who they are going to get on the West Coast. You know, they're not typically getting the upper crust guys, but to your point, they do get guys here and there that I don't want to say should, because it's obviously an individual choice, but should in most cases be in pro baseball. They get those guys too periodically. And that's obviously, I think we've seen time and again, when you're recruiting at the high end, you have to find ways to get those kind of guys every so often. I guess the question I would have for you is, as you started to put this together, I know UCLA was an obvious winner, quote unquote, coming out of the draft for the reasons you articulated. Was it at that point that they kind of felt like the number one recruiting class for you? Obviously, I'm sure you didn't just put it in pen. You know, you had to consider these things, but how easy or difficult was the decision for UCLA at one? Did you come into this process kind of assuming they would be one? What was kind of the, you know, how did that shape up as time went on?
in the immediate aftermath of the draft, I thought there were four classes that had a case to be number one. You had UCLA, you had Florida, which winds up, and these four wound up being the top four. You had Florida, which winds up at number two. It's a really strong, deep class. It was the number one class on signing day. They did, however, see their top or three. They saw three players drafted in the first 30 picks out of their class. So you kind of locked the very top end of Florida off. Otherwise, they did a good job in terms of retaining the rest of the class. You had Vanderbilt, which, you know, consistently deep, good. We know how Vanderbilt recruits. They also did lose a couple through the draft process. And then Arkansas was kind of the fourth of the group, but they wound up with Peyton Stovall, who is the second highest player not to be picked out of the 500 from prep level. Or that's on camp, you know, Kamar Rocker kind of throws off how I have to talk about that, but he was the second highest ranked high school prospect that made it to campus. And so that's a really good headliner. And there was a time that I thought Braylon Bishop might not sign. That was a little unclear in the immediate aftermath. He said that he wasn't going to sign, that he was going to go to Fayetteville, and then the tweet got deleted, and ultimately Braylon Bishop did sign, and that kind of made Arkansas the clear four of the group. But they have a good class as well. And so if you then, once the signing deadline passed, look at it and say, at that point, I think it kind of became, well, it's either UCLA or Florida. And, you know, I talk to people, I look at it, and ultimately I think that UCLA just had a little more high end talent. Than Florida. I think Florida's class, I think it's bigger and therefore it runs a little deeper in certain ways, but UCLA's just like premium talent is what pushed it over the top to number one. I mean, you're talking about Thatcher Hurd, who is a top 50 player in the BA 500. And it's important to remember that the BA 500 includes all players who obviously wouldn't be a part of recruiting rankings, but Thatcher Hurd was a top 50 prospect in the draft class. They have Gage Jump, who's another pitcher that's a top 100 prospect. Malachi Knight, an outstanding outfielder, was a top 100 prospect. And then the two players who removed themselves from draft consideration, Nick McLean, he's the youngest brother of Matt McLean. He's another outfielder, and shortstop Cody Schreier. I think McLean, before he removed himself from the draft, and then we had to remove them from the 500 because the 500 is only for draftable players. Nick was a top 100 player, and Schreier was just outside the top 100. So you're looking at two more players that we consider to be top 125 prospects in the draft. And at this point, I've named five, six of those guys, I guess. So that's what we're talking about here with this UCLA class. And it runs deeper than that. You're running into a whole lot of really good pitchers, some good position players that didn't quite make the 500. And it's so that kind of is what pushed it over the top at UCLA. And I guess this is now, I should have mentioned this before, but it's as good a time as any. This is just ranking incoming freshmen and junior college transfers. Four-year transfers do not count towards our rankings. And I believe that's going to be my final decision. Like this year, I kind of like, still a little bit unclear how to handle that, just in terms of the rule change being so fresh. But I think that I'm leaning towards never including four-year transfers, just because, you know, I start ranking these classes on signing day at a time when we don't know who's going to be available in the transfer portal. So to have gone through and like done all of the process and like, these are the classes. And then suddenly in June, when players start transferring, to like throw all that that this exercise doesn't need. So importantly, this is just the newcomers from the prep ranks and the junior college ranks. And I don't think that really affects any, either Florida or UCLA, but, Arkansas, if you could include Jace Borhoffman into it, that would be a little bit of a different story perhaps. But if we're just looking at the freshmen and the junior college transfers here.
Yeah, Arkansas also, Michael Turner, Kent State catcher, nice piece there. Obviously, Borhoffman's the headline name there, but another nice piece for Arkansas. They typically play well in the portal, but I think that's the right, while we're here, I think that's the right decision in terms of not including the four-year transfers for the reasons you articulated, but also the teams at the top. I mean, Arkansas is a little bit of an exception where they played pretty heavily in the transfer. Now, it didn't all work out. They had some of their guys sign last year in 2020, but they play in the portal quite a bit. But most of the teams we're talking about in this top section, especially the teams we have 1, 2, and 3, they're not really the types of programs that are playing a ton in the transfer portal. So it's just ultimately, I think you're going to be talking about teams in the back half of the 25, which to your point is just going to make this already difficult exercise even more so. And how do you value a highly ranked kid who went to campus and it didn't work out at his first stop? Well, how do you value that player versus others? So
I already struggle with junior college players. Like, okay, right. If you get a really good junior college player, that's an impact for 1 year. Mm-hmm. Max, you're looking at 2. Obviously, right now, with everyone having the extra year, some of it is longer than that. But ordinarily, you're looking at 1, maybe 2 years versus at least 2. There are draft-eligible sophomores out there, but usually 3, maybe 4 years. And how do you value a junior college player who could make an immediate impact anyway? So that's already hard. And then if I had to throw grad transfers or, full-on 4-year transfers into the mix, it gets complicated pretty quickly. So at least for now, though, we're sticking with the way that we've been doing it. And I do think this is probably the way we're going to do this going forward as well, and just have a separate ranking for transfer classes.
One program that is playing a lot in the transfer portal that also has a top 5 recruiting class is Tennessee. Like, that's just such an interesting team for me in 2022, because I think you and I have both gone back and forth on what to expect from Tennessee in 2022, because like they do have a good number of guys leaving. They also have a really intriguing group of players returning, and they got a few guys who could have moved on as, guys who have already been in the program for 4 or 5 years that chose to come back. And now they're bringing in some really impressive transfer talent, and here they are with a top 5 recruiting class. And it sounds like, just reading your write-up on it, that there are a number of guys, some of these guys are a little more projectable, are going to take some time, but there are some high-end talents here that appear ready to have roles right out of the gate. And so, the whole Tennessee project here under Tony Vitello is fascinating, but this is when we talk about how difficult it is to pull yourself up by your bootstraps in the SEC, because everyone is recruiting at a high level, just about everyone anyway. But this is how you do it. I mean, this is the process. This is Tennessee going through that process of being a program that was down for so long. And little by little, it starts with the baby steps they took in 2018 and 2019. And now it feels like this is a program full on, kind of full speed ahead. The train is really moving here. With this top 5 class, I would put, just as a segue to maybe another team here, but Alabama is kind of in that same process. They're not as far along as Tennessee, but here they are with a top 10 class. And so we talk about how difficult life is in the SEC, but like sitting right here before us are two programs in Tennessee and Alabama that appear to be doing all of the right things to actually pull off what is one of the more difficult tasks in college baseball.
Yeah. And, you can look, Auburn went through this before. They landed a top 10 class at 18 or 19. I think it was 19 was their top 10 class. And maybe it was 18 though. Regardless, they hit the recruiting hard when Butch Thompson got there, and it paid off with the College World Series appearance. Tennessee now had the World Series appearance and is getting this top 5 class off the back of it. Really without, you have to remember, in in baseball, you're not going to see the benefit necessarily from reaching the College World Series for another at least a year and probably 2 years to truly show up in recruiting. Like, this group committed to Tony Vitello before he showed that, look, we can get back to the World Series. That, to use one of Joe's favorite terms, that proof of concept, it wasn't there yet. And now it is. But this class, when they signed it, they had Brady House in it. And obviously he went on to be a first round pick to the Nationals and was one of the best high school players in the country. And I remember like looking at it in the fall and thinking, well, okay, like Brady House makes this really interesting, but like, he's probably not going to make it. Well, it still wound up being a really interesting class, even without him. Maddox Bruns is the highest ranked player in it. He was number 49 in the BA 500. Again, I mean, there aren't many players ranked ahead of him that made it to campus. So in him, they have this big arm right-hander that has a fastball that touches 100 and, you know, should be able to make a pretty immediate impact. And you start putting that with, you know, you saw what Blake Tidwell did as a freshman last year under Frank Anderson's tutelage on the mound. Like, I mean, you start stacking these guys together, and that's how you know, build pitching staffs and rebuild pitching staffs. And you know, like they got some innings that they have to go around. And if Maddox Bruns, or Burns rather, can get into it as a freshman, I mean, that would be very, very big for them. And they also got significantly Seth Stevenson, who's a junior college transfer. He he can come in and he has just incredible speed. He and Ryan Spikes both can kind of play up the middle. And so those are two really important recruits as well. So yeah, Tennessee has been getting after it, recruiting under Vitello. I mean, that's part of the reason why he got this job. It's because he's known as being such an aggressive recruiter who really wants to get out there. And like, I mean, in his old job as recruiting coordinator, obviously he had to get out there and get after it, but he has continued that as a head coach. And I think one thing that you'll notice here with most of the classes in the top five, Vanderbilt's a little bit different. Not that Tim Corbin doesn't hit the trail, but maybe a little bit less than some of the other head coaches. But you know, John Savage, very active in recruiting. Kevin O'Sullivan, Tony Vitello are out there all the time. And Dave Van Horn really gets after it too, especially. So having a head coach that is as invested in the process as those guys are, and again, Tim Corbin is pretty heavily out there as well. It just means so much for a program. You only have three coaches that can recruit in college baseball, with only the three full-time coaches can get out there. And you know, so if you're a head coach and you're not going out there, I mean, that's fine. That model can work. But you got to have, if you are going to be involved, I just think that's such a big advantage to the whole process. And obviously I'm not a coach. I don't, well, everyone has their different things that they've got to, you know, get into, and running a program is not easy, and delegation, all the rest of it. But those guys are really invested, and you're seeing it pay off here. I want to touch on Alabama a little bit here in a second. With some of these other teams that maybe are a little less blue bloody than what we've seen here so far in the top five. But first, check this out. All right, Joe, you mentioned Alabama before I made us take that little break there. This is Alabama's first top 10 class since 2012. They had a couple top 15 classes. I just really like this class from what they're bringing in on the mound. It's not a very heavy class in terms of position players, and I think that's okay in the immediate. They needed the help on the mound more than they just returned more players positionally. And they went out and they got some really good, really good arms here. You're looking at like Luke Holman, and Brandon Clark, just these, and Ben Hess, all three of them just really big bodied guys who are going to, you know, be able to run their fastballs up pretty high. And so I'm excited for that. And then from a position player standpoint, they get Camden Hayslip, who is actually their top ranked recruit. Again, just big physical, could be a center fielder for them, but certainly going to find somewhere to play in the outfield, and a great left-handed powerful bat to add to the lineup. So yeah, it's things are happening there in Tuscaloosa. Recruiting in the SEC is insane. When you have four of the top five classes nationally all coming from the SEC, obviously everything is a little relative there, but you just need to stack the premium talent to be able to compete. And I think more importantly than looking at like, well, is Alabama the fifth best recruiting class in the SEC, or, you know, whatever, that's all fine. I think the more important thing is for any of these SEC schools is just you have to keep bringing in the premium talent. You have to keep stacking it, and you know, you can develop other pieces, but it, more importantly than having it than say Ole Miss, which is number 25 in the top 25 and therefore is like the 10th or 11th best SEC recruiting class. I mean, you can look at that one of two ways, but the way I look at it is just that you got to just keep stacking the premium talent, and you know, good things will come. Everything's a little cyclical. If you take a big class this year, you probably can't take a big class next year. But as long as you keep stacking premium guys year after year, you're going to be fine as an SEC school.
It's also a good reminder, just by the way, to fans listening who are a little bit uninitiated to the process, is that, like, yes, I'll put it this way, and maybe you'll disagree with this assessment, but being high in a recruiting ranking is obviously a good thing. It does take a Rhodes Scholar to suss that out. But being lower, especially within, like, when you talk about in the SEC, being lower in the pecking order, not necessarily an indictment of the recruiting class, because you mentioned the class size is also a thing. It's also class need, right? I mean, if you're a team that's in a certain cycle where you've got a lot returning and you will have a lot returning the next couple of years, you can maybe take some projects or, you know, things like that. Some guys who aren't maybe necessarily the guys who are very present in the rankings and are very clearly going to be contributors in year one. So while it may be an indictment, I'm not saying it's not, but I just don't think it's necessarily any reason to make any assumptions about the recruiting prowess of the staff. It could just be circumstantial that this year ends up being a lighter year from a recruiting standpoint. So I think that's a good distinction to make there. That it's a little bit more nuanced than that.
There's also just quickly in football, which is, I think, where most people are most familiar with recruiting rankings from, there's a hard cap. You can only sign 25 players. That's an actual rule. So the max anyone is signing in any given year is 25. There's no such rule in baseball. A lot of the best classes wind up really being very big. I do my best not to penalize schools that take smaller classes in any given year. UCLA often has a pretty small class compared to some of the other classes at the top of the rankings. Not as true this year. They had one of the highest, most, they had some of the or few schools had more draftees than UCLA did this year. So they had a lot of holes to fill, but I try not to just let the small classes slip to the bottom just on the basis of them being small. But obviously the more players you get, the more bites at the apple you have. And so bigger classes tend to fare better in the rankings. That's just one of the unfortunate things that I haven't been able to figure out how to fix yet. And I don't know that it is fixable, but so yes, if you have a smaller class, I try hard not to let that really influence the ranking, but it probably is going to at the end of the day.
Cool. More quick top 10 notes here in terms of teams ranked in the top 10. Welcome back, Oregon State. Number six here, first, it says here, first ranked class since 2016. That being a famous class, Adley Rutschman was in it. And if you do the math, a couple years later, that worked out pretty well for the Beavers. So I'd say that's another positive step. We've talked a lot about Oregon State on this show, and understandably so.
Because I'm really into Oregon State right now. And this class is part of it. Like I, it could be fifth. You know, I might look at that. I kept going back and forth with it on Tennessee. Ultimately, I just decided Maddox Burns was kind of a separator, but maybe they should be five. You know, there's a real case for that.
Chase Burns, I meant to clean that up. I'm glad you said it again.
Yes, Maddox Bruns was committed to Mississippi State, and I was very concerned that both he and Chase Burns were going to make it to school, and I was never going to be able to figure them out, and yet here it is. Maddox Bruns signed, and I still can't keep them straight.
It got you either way. Maddox Bruns. Shout out to UMS Wright Prep. What were we talking? Oh, Oregon State. But yeah, there's just been a lot going on in that program. We've detailed it in the past. You know, we don't have to relitigate all of it, but just kind of with their head coaching situation and not knowing what to expect. And then last year in 2020, they weren't very good. In 2021, they really bounced back, but we still kind of didn't know what to make of them. And now they're recruiting really well. So they just continue to be a really fascinating program, but it does seem like things are trending in a very, very positive direction for them. They come in at number six. Number nine is Duke. I think people who are at least paying some attention to this will recognize that Alex Mooney is a big part of that. I think there was a lot made, understandably so, of him choosing to go to Duke rather than begin his professional career. You know, he's a top 100, top 75 BA 500 prospect who is at Duke. That's a new thing for Duke. Having a recruiting class ranked this high is a new thing for Duke. My curiosity that I would pose to you is, what is in this class other than Alex Mooney? Because ultimately that's going to have a lot of bearing on what this class ends up being. Alex Mooney might be a superstar, but obviously there'll need to be more to it than that if this group is going to live up to its potential. But those are two programs. Oregon State obviously is now a blue blood in college baseball, but I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, and you haven't been doing this for that long, but you have, you know, you've been looking over the historical data as well. You know, Oregon State, you know, I don't really associate them with being the program, even in their best years, that have necessarily had like these standout recruiting classes. They've tended to be kind of a development program. And Duke, certainly, just because they don't have a lot of history, have not been in this position. But there they are at 6 and 9 in the top 10 of these rankings.
Yeah, Duke has never had a class ranked this high. Oregon State, you got to go back to 2013, they were number 5, and 2007, they were number 3. Those are the only classes that have been higher than this one. Obviously, whiffed on how good the 2015 class that had Madrigal and Grenier and Larnick should have been. Re-ranked class, that was number 2. It was number 12 at the time, so not terribly wrought on my part, but also like that class is probably the class that everyone is at Oregon State is trying to live up to for the end of time now. So we'll see what they can do. I also, notably on Oregon State, before I go on to Duke, they have some good draft prospects in it. Jacob Kmatz, coming from New Mexico. Mason Guerra, the Oregon Gatorade Player of the Year. He's a shortstop. Kmatz is a pitcher. Those guys were top 200 types. And Tyree Reed, outfielder with all kinds of pedigree, played for USA Baseball going back to like 15U, and had some first round consideration. Like if you were talking about him this time last year, just he was limited by some injuries this spring, kind of fell out of that, but is going to be very good for them. But the player that I'm maybe most intrigued by, just because of what, like, those players are all very good. I'm intrigued by them. But Travis Bazana, is an Australian native. So he was not eligible for the Pro Bowl. He would have signed as an international player. He came over here this summer, played in the West Coast League, broke the West Coast League's single season record for batting average, hit 429. The previous record was held by Austin Shenton, who is now a prospect in the Rays system. And he did that as like an 18-year-old adjusting to living in America. So he is super intriguing to me. Just it's a top of the order kind of hitter, middle infielder. just, we don't see many players like taking his path into college baseball. So I'm fascinated by that. And then also by the fact that he's coming off of this incredible summer playing in the West Coast League. So that this class, I think, has a real chance to be really good and make me look dumb for not putting it into the top five already. But I'm excited by that. And then you look at Duke, and I'm going to throw Wake Forest into this. Sorry, Duke. These two things are too similar. Wake Forest has never had a top 25 class. We're now leaving the top 10. Wake Forest is number 13, Duke number 9. They both did they're both similar, both in the school's profile and kind of similar spots in the rankings, and also how they got there. You mentioned Mooney for Duke. He's a Michigan prep middle infielder, could play shortstop for Duke as soon as this year, but very athletic, instant impact. Jonathan Santucci is probably the other one that people are most excited about there. He's got two-way ability as an outfielder and a left-hander, probably more likely to make the impact as a position player. But excited about that, excited about some of the arms, Ryan Higgins, Brandon Schell, Jimmy Romano, who maybe could fill a Jack Lebosky type role for Duke as a two-way player. And then you look at Wake Forest, and so Duke ranked as high as it is in part by getting Mooney to campus. Wake Forest gets Josh Hartle, one of the top prep lefties in this draft class, to campus. He removed his name from the draft. He was a top 50 prospect, first round consideration. Like, I think he was in the 30s when he removed himself from the draft and therefore we removed him from the 500. And this is Wake Forest doing that. Like, now Wake Forest has had a first round pick as a pitcher in back-to-back years. So, you know, we understand what they do in terms of pitching development, the investment they've made in terms of pitching facilities, and you're seeing that pay off. But now you're also seeing a payoff in that you get a guy like Josh Hartle, who could reasonably have been a top 50 draft pick this year, maybe a top 30, you know, as a first rounder, saying, no, I want to go to Wake Forest. And when you think about where that program has come from, you know, there's so many things in recent years that achievements they've hit that have been like, wow, look at how far Wake Forest is coming, you know, especially making that super regional. And I just feel like getting to be this level for like prime recruits, not recruits that you're necessarily going to have to develop into being first rounders, but here's a guy that was already being thought of at that level that's saying, no, I want to go there and get even better.
Yeah, it's been what a journey for Wake Forest over the last several years, because it both feels like just yesterday and also 15 years ago they were in that super regional. They had a highly touted group of players come in immediately after
that. It's not their fault that COVID happened, because that's part of the reason it feels like it was so long ago.
True. Everything feels like it was so long ago. That is a great point by you. But, you know, they have this really highly touted group and talented group of players. Like, I don't mean to disparage them, like productive players the last few years in the program. And it just didn't amount to much winning, you know? And so it was this kind of team that every year, you know, you look at them and you can kind of squint and be like, man, you know, there's something here. And it just never quite came together. So I'll be fascinated to see what this next group does. And, it, you know, there's a pretty talented group of guys on campus right now, led by Brock Wilkin, Eric Adler, guys like that. And then you add this group to it. Should be just a fascinating team in Winston-Salem moving forward. I will do a thing now where I will open it up. So we've got some teams that we often see in this part of the recruiting rankings are ranked relatively high, whether you talk about no shots to NC State at 11. It's a good class. They've got some good transfers coming in. That's a fascinating team. But, you know, TCU comes in at 12, LSU is 14, Georgia 15, South Carolina 16. You know, Florida State comes in at 19, Louisville at 20. Are there any classes there that have moved, whether it was, hey, this team really suffered some attrition in the draft, or teams that made late movement in a positive direction where you kind of reevaluated things, or they came to the draft better than you thought? Because there are some blue bloody type of teams that, frankly, while these are good classes, are more teams that are used to having more like top 10 classes. So I'm kind of curious about the movement you might have seen there.
Yeah, LSU and TCU are probably the two biggest movers, and they're going in opposite directions. LSU was a top five class on signing day, and you might say, like, oh, well, things happen when you change coaches, and maybe that's why. No, they just the top four players like got lopped off to go to the draft. And now maybe some of that was, and I haven't read any of their quotes, maybe some of that was like, oh, well, if Paul Maneri is not there, like, that was who I dream for playing for Paul Maneri. But that's what happened to them. They got hit hard in the draft, and I don't think anyone's going to cry for LSU when you see what they did in the transfer portal. So it's a good recruiting class that, if you were to include their transfers, would be outstanding. So that's kind of what happened there. They're hitting LSU's new staff is definitely out there hitting it hard in future years, future recruiting classes. Jay Johnson, Dan Fitzgerald, Jason Kelly, all really good recruiters. So they're definitely out there. They're hitting it. But, you know, when you inherit a job as late as they did and the drafts as late as it is, you know, it's always hard to kind of remake a recruiting class if you do get hit hard in the draft. And so they kind of went about that through the transfer portal rather than anything else. And so that's why they slipped like 10 spots to 14 here. TCU, on the other hand, I did not rank on signing day, and maybe that was a mistake on my part. Maybe, you know, I do know TCU came through the draft really well. They wound up losing, I think it was two recruits, one on the high school side, one on the junior college side. But to have kept that class together as well as they did through a coaching change is incredibly impressive. Now, obviously, there is a lot of stability still at TCU. A lot of, you know, a lot of things stayed the same, even though Jim Schlossnick left. Kirk Sarlous was just promoted to head coach. Bill Mosiello is still there. So a lot of the guys that the recruits would have been used to talking to and were expecting to work with, they are still there at TCU. And so maybe that helped them keep things as stable as they were able to through the draft. And they wind up with some really good players here. Thomas DeLandry is a top 150 player in the BA 500, one of the toolsiest freshmen in the country. He's just got all kinds of athleticism and tools. And obviously he's going to need to refine his game a little bit if, you know, we're talking about him that way and he didn't get drafted. But everything is there for them to work with. And they've got some exciting pitchers coming in. Cademan Parker is really good now and has projection. That's kind of, you know, the perfect kind of college pitcher. Good enough to have success now, but the projection to become like a frontline starter in a couple of years, like that's one of the just the sweet spots to hit in this recruiting stuff, I feel like. And Gray Thomas has this funky delivery. It's a totally unique look out there as a sidearmer. So I'd be very interested to see how TCU and Kirk Sarlous use him. And Hunter Holland is a left-hander who spent one season at San Jack, got drafted in the 15th round, but decided he wanted to come to TCU as opposed to going to pro ball. So again, just adding to that pitching staff. And we did not have Hunter Teplansky ranked in the 500 or Logan Maxwell. But I think both of those guys on the position player side, Teplansky as a shortstop and Maxwell as an outfielder, A, could have fit in the 500. One of the things you learn about doing the 500 is that the difference between a player in the 400s and the 500s is not as great as putting a number next to their names makes it appear. I think both of those players could have fit in a 500, or if we'd expanded to 600, maybe they would have been there. But to get those guys, I think is significant. And Teplansky, especially as a middle infielder, I mean, you can never have enough of those guys. So I like what TCU was able to put together. And I think that's, you know, as Kirk Sarlous tries to build momentum now, as he adjusts to being a head coach, I think he's got a lot of intriguing pieces to work with here.
You mentioned Dan Fitzgerald being at LSU now is an excellent recruiter. And I think you can look at the team ranked number 18 here in Dallas Baptist and see that that's the case, because his fingerprints are all over this class. And, you know, big shoes to fill for Cliff Pennington, who is highly thought of Texas A&M legend Cliff Pennington, now in the recruiting coordinator role at DBU, a program that in a lot of ways, this is not to underplay the skill the recruiters have, but a program that sells itself to a certain player, I think now at this point, that the success they've had is to a level now where I think they do have kind of a some built-in recruiting advantages they're able to take advantage of. And so here they have a number 18 recruiting class. So I'd be curious, where this kind of feels like to you among classes from non-power conferences, like not, non-Big West division, I guess I would say. Because this is a program that, as we talked about before, that is just kind of knocking on the door. And Jim Schlossnagel, to repeat something we've said a few times, said it's an Omaha program that hasn't gotten there yet. There's an assumption about their ability to get there. Perhaps this class is a part of it. Certainly it's positive momentum. I assume that, I assume this is the first time they've been a top 25 class. Correct me if I'm wrong, but
that's correct.
Yeah. So that certainly is another piece of that puzzle put together and another step in that direction. But not knowing how often this type of thing happens, it would be easy, I think, in my position to look at it and say, well, this is a groundbreaking thing for this program. So bigger steps forward are in the offing when maybe perhaps it is a step in that direction, but maybe perhaps it's more common than I realized for a team to put up a class like this. And then maybe it doesn't necessarily always lead to that next thing.
Yeah, I think it happens about once a year that we get a team like this. BYU a couple of years ago, ranked number 25. We've seen FIU in this kind of range a few times under Mervell Melendez. Obviously, neither of those has really truly popped the way that either of those programs would have preferred it to happen. And you can look at COVID as some of the reason why that might have happened to BYU. Obviously, things have been, this is that class's junior year. So we'll see what comes of that in the next couple of years. But sometimes it also does, it also is very meaningful. UCSB coming off of its first Omaha appearance, spent a couple of years in this range. They've continued to be pretty good. And while Washington is not, they are a power conference program, but, they broke through ahead of, in 2015, they broke through with the number 15 class. It was the first time UW had a top 25 class. And they build on that the next year with another highly ranked class. I think it was number 9. And then they wound up in Omaha a couple years later. So, sometimes things like that happen. I guess I should also shout out East Carolina. A couple years ago, stacked top 20 class or top 25 classes in this range. And you saw how close they got to Omaha with Brickhouse and Packard leading the way. So it could be really meaningful. It might not be. My guess is with DBU, this is going to be meaningful because they've already won, and now you're adding this kind of talent. The interesting thing about this DBU class is, yes, it has some extremely high-end talent. Kevin Basil behind the plate is going to be a really good bat. Luke Hefner, Dan Hefner's son, is a really advanced shortstop, plays like he's a coach's kid, and should be able to step in pretty well. Ryan Johnson has two-way impact, probably more likely as a pitcher, but he's got great stuff, projectable. He's kind of the headliner of this group. And but then they also have a whole bunch of really good junior college players, and we've seen how good DBU is at identifying junior college talent. And so they stack a lot of them into this class. And with that group, they should be able to have some immediate needs filled. And I think that's important for DBU to be able to build off of this season and the super regional.
I guess the last thing, specific question I had, and then I suppose I'll let you fill in any holes that I failed to touch on here before I wrap up with a as a little tease here for the listeners, I've got a few names I want to put on a watch list for our all names team that I pulled from these top 25 recruiting rankings. But, you know, we have to have a dialogue about USC. I feel like we do this every year. They ranked class last year. Just never know quite what to do with USC and them having talented recruiting classes, because so often with USC, talent has not been the problem. You just look at their drafted players, like, you know, that they're always getting guys drafted, even from teams that weren't very good, and players that frankly weren't necessarily the most productive guys in the world. So talent has been a thing at USC. It just hasn't amounted to too much. But now, you know, maybe 2021 was a little bit of a step back for USC. And again, you look at the players that they had on that roster, and there was some talent there, and they showed that in 2020. They were off to a good start, and now they're stacking back-to-back top 25 classes under Jason Gill at USC. And, you know, I think maybe it's the old school college baseball fan in me that is kind of intrigued by the idea of USC. And even if we agree, and I think this is safe to assume, if we all agree that USC is never going to be the USC that we saw 40 years ago for about a million different reasons we could do a whole episode on, I do think there is still this feeling that, you know, that it should amount to more than it has amounted as of late. So perhaps these are positive steps in the right direction. There's really no specific question here. It's just more like, you know, here we are with USC again. And I'm just excited to see, intrigued to see what it ends up being in 2022 when you combine back-to-back ranked recruiting classes on top of each other with a group that has shown some positive signs over the last couple of years under Coach Gill.
So what I'm most interested in this USC group, and I need to spend more time talking to folks at USC to maybe better understand this, and I have some ideas about why it might have ended up this way, but they left Southern California a lot for this class. And, you know, you're looking at Eric Hammond, who is a big right-hander with some upside, as the headliner. And he's also, like, he was a top 100 player in the 500. You could make an argument he was the best prep right-hander in Texas, not in Southern California, where we would kind of associate, like, their players mostly coming from. Usually they went to Texas, and they went and they got Harrison Feinberg, who's this incredible athlete who runs around the outfield really well, from Connecticut. And they went and they got Matt Keating, who should be a back end of the bullpen guy who could also hit for them, from the Nebraska junior college ranks. And, you know, so some of this is because Ted Silva, now USC's pitching coach and recruiting coordinator, because he came to USC from Nebraska. So he has some of these different kind of recruiting relationships and experience recruiting different areas than, you know, a staff that is just Southern California based. So that's happening. But, you know, it is interesting that they're casting a pretty wide net. We don't see that very often on the West Coast, but you can have success doing it. And if this group pops, you know, maybe they're going to be able to hit on something going forward. But I'll be interested to see how this all comes together. I think that they've got some intriguing players here, but you're right. Like, that's never really been USC's problem. They've often had ranked recruiting classes, often in this range or a little lower. And, you know, they've continued to have the ups and downs on the field that they've had. So it's going to be about how well they can, you know, bring on board these guys, you know, bring them into their system, coach them up. But I mean, you look at Hammond and he has the ability to become a big time piece in their rotation going forward. Caden Huber made a jump this year as a hitter, probably fits best at third base, could be a really good player for them as well, ranked just outside the 200 in terms of the draft prospects. So I like what they're putting together, but yeah, at this point, I would like to see it, the next step now be made. And look, Jason Gill hasn't been there very long. Obviously things have been confused in terms of, like, it just hasn't been a clean kind of off season. So we'll see what they can do now going into 2022.
It does make some, that is interesting. I hadn't noticed the kind of diversity and geography of this recruiting class for USC. And it does make some sense. I mean, there's, you know, highly
it's
academic
a big brand
for sure. And highly academic national brand programs often recruit that way. And yes. I know, you know, Stanford does some of that stuff. I mean, you mentioned player from Nebraska, you know, Kyle Peterson, one of Stanford's most famous players the last couple of decades, who is, you know, an Omaha native. You know, Michigan, they're not a private school, but a highly academic school that recruits nationally, like they do a lot of that stuff.
Yeah, I mean, Stanford, Vanderbilt, TCU, right? Like these programs are like USC in a lot of ways, and they recruit nationally. Miami is kind of trying to get back to that. They went a little insular for a while, but they have a very long history of going to California to recruit. And so, you know, I've noticed that Miami's been trying to widen its base again. And, you know, I mean, these schools all have huge brands and pretty good academics to sell, great academics in a lot of those cases that we're mentioning. And so, yeah, there's no reason why USC can't be doing this. It's just, it's a shift. And so I'll be interested to see whether it's a long-term shift or is this a thing that they did because, you know, in the transition. You know, recruiting in California sometimes is even on a more advanced level. You know, the timelines are more advanced than in other parts of the country. Is that why this happened? Is it, you know, I don't have the answers to all of that yet, but I will be interested to see how it progresses.
All right. So is there anything that I did not ask you that I have failed, that I should have asked you, and I failed my job as kind of the de facto host on this episode because you've got most of the information here. So is there any gaps need to be filled in before I hit you with a few names to put on this all names team watch list?
Well, I think there are two things I want to say. One is that Clemson landed the highest ranked player from the BA 500 in Will Taylor. He's an outfielder. You also will be seeing him on the football field this fall. And I get really excited about the two sport guys, but they do come with a little bit of, you know, you just need a little bit of caution sometimes because football is a part of what they do. We got very excited when Jerry Neely came to Ole Miss and, you know, yes, COVID is a part of the reason why we haven't seen much of him playing baseball, but we haven't seen much of him playing baseball. And, you know, Maurice Hampton left LSU, you know, like these things happen. Kyler Murray had to transfer from A&M for football reasons. So I think Will Taylor's a little more focused on baseball than some of the guys I mentioned, especially Kyler. But what's going to happen with him as a football player also affects what happens with him as a baseball player. That being said, very excited to watch Will Taylor this spring at Clemson. And then the other thing is Nebraska comes in at number 21. The Huskers have not had a ranked recruiting class since 2013. The Will Bolt era continues to get off to a really strong start here. You saw them win the Big Ten this spring. Now they have the top ranked recruiting class in the Big Ten. And they do it with two really dynamic players. Drew Christo is a right-hander, was the Nebraska Gatorade Player of the Year. Again, projection combined with present stuff, just the perfect kind of college player in a lot of ways. Very excited about what he can become there. And then Chase Mason is this ultra toolsy player from South Dakota. That is, he is still incredibly raw, though. Not surprising for a multi-sport athlete from South Dakota. His development, watching that, is going to be very interesting. He could turn into an absolute monster, though. So interesting things happening in Lincoln. But, I mean, the class is more than those guys. And this is a chance, though, for Nebraska to keep building on what they've already accomplished under Will Bolt.
As a professional segue to putting players on the all-name team watch list, Drew Christo, as you informed me, the son of the magnificently named former Nebraska quarterback, Monte Christo.
It's incredible.
I mean, just chef's kiss, honestly. But yeah, whether it's the sandwich, the book, you know, just a fabulous name. So we will use that as a transition into, I've got six names here. There are certainly more that could have gone on this list, but I was trying to keep it tight. Some of these guys will inevitably end up on the all names team. Also, just a little bit of a disclaimer here. I'm just scrolling through Teddy's write-ups of the top 25. So the entire recruiting classes are not listed here. So inevitably there is a great name or two that I have failed to list here among these that are going on the all names watch list, but here they are.
That said, you had 250 names to choose from, because I write up pretty much 10-ish per class.
Well, there you go. So that's a pretty good sampling. So I've got six here that really stood out. Like I said, I'm sure there are more that I could have put on here. I tried to keep it to just kind of one per, no more than one for each team. I'm looking at you, Duke, because Duke had a number of good names. Okay, so first off, Clemson left-hander Rocco Reed. Just because I feel like we should be making more Roccos. We need more Roccos in the world. That's just a really good name. I imagine he's like a 1950s greaser with a leather jacket, you know, Rocco Reed. Nebraska right-hander Jackson Jelkin. That is J-A-X-O-N, taking the torch and the baton from a Jackson Hallmark. In Nebraska, there's also a Jackson with an X, Jackson Wiggins at Arkansas. Teddy and I talked offline about how that was probably the popularity of the name Jackson, J-A-X-O-N, really must have peaked about 20 years ago with these players who have been in college baseball the last few years. So that's another one. Florida State catcher Satchel Norman. When I was in high school, I asked a girl out one time, and she said no, because she was actually more into this guy who went to her church, and his name was Satchel. As it turned out, I will try not to hold that against Satchel Norman in his college career. Although, you know, I'm married now. I think she's actually married now too, although I don't keep up with her. So it's worked out well for both of us. But there's that. South Carolina outfielder Thaddeus Ector, which sounds like a supervillain in a Marvel movie.
I want to asterisk that. I think he probably is going by Thad, but we had him as Thaddeus in the 500. And I agree, it sounds really cool. So if you're listening, Thad, maybe keep Thaddeus.
Yeah, let that name breathe. Thaddeus Ector. That's just big time supervillain vibes there. Mississippi State left-hander Pico Cone. He gets in under the Itchy Burt's clause in this. His real first name is William. However, he is listed as Pico. So the rule is, of course, whatever name you put on the roster is the name we consider for the all names team. So if we got any players listening, you know, put whatever name on the roster that you want to go by so we can consider it.
There's somebody, I don't remember who it was, but there was a Bear somebody on like the, in a class that I was at least considering for the 25, who apparently goes by Bear, but like baseball wise may or may not. So that is whoever you are. That's the one to consider.
Yeah. Just put whatever name on the, you know, don't be ridiculous with it. You know, if you go by a name though, like put down there, give us things to consider. So put your nickname there, but I imagine the puns with Pico, you know, spicy Pico, things like that are endless, of course, with a guy named Pico. Then finally, I mentioned Duke having several to choose from. I went with infielder Tyler Christmas simply because that is my favorite holiday. And that's it. Those are the six names I'm putting on the all names team watch list for this next year.
That is, that's a good one for Duke. But yeah, like you said, Duke has several out there. So yes, some very intriguing names coming into college baseball, both in every sense of that word. So exciting times here as we get to get into the into depth on these recruiting classes. So yeah, check the whole thing out over at baseballamerica.com. I go deep on all of these classes. Like I said, I mean, I wrote up about 10 players for 25 classes. There's a lot of players to read up on and kind of get familiar with. So check that all out over at baseballamerica.com. Joe and I will be back with another edition of the Baseball America College Podcast next week. Reminder, we're going weekly throughout the off season. So make sure you are subscribed to the Baseball America podcast wherever you get your podcasts, Apple Podcast, Stitcher, Spotify, wherever you can find us, and hit the subscribe button. You can follow us on Twitter. I'm at Ted Cahill. Joe is at Joe Healy BA. And again, there's plenty to read over at the website, baseballamerica.com. Until next time, I want to thank you all for listening. I want to thank you to Rapsodo for presenting this and every episode of the Baseball America College podcast. I'm Teddy. He's Joe. We'll talk to you next time.